This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland, and today we celebrate Independence Day with a one-hour tribute to an original American art form. We call it Red, White, and the Blues. Blues music arose from the African-American experience in the South. On the farms and in fields, black slaves sang to keep their spirits up, spread the news, and sometimes relay secret messages. In church, they sang gospel music. At work, the blues. Blues music went on to become the basic DNA for jazz, R&B, rock and roll, rap, and almost every manner of modern music. On today's program, we'll listen to some blues and learn about this music through the lens of the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. The music we're profiling is being preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry because of its historical, cultural, or aesthetic importance to our society. They're as much a part of our heritage as God Bless America, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, or When You Wish Upon a Star, all of which are also in the registry. Anyone can nominate a recording for the registry. It just has to be at least 10 years old, and there has to be an existing copy. Last year, the public nominated over 600 recordings, and then a blue ribbon panel of experts added another 150. From that long list, the Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden, picked 25 recordings to add to the registry.
When I look at a list and I see Memphis Minnie, 1941, the blues, it's called Me and My Chauffeur Blues. It's a way of saying, whoa, not only is the title something, but who was Memphis Minnie? So you want to make sure that people are possibly intrigued and want to dig a little deeper and find out, did anybody else record that? And who was Memphis Minnie?
Let's dig a little deeper right now. Memphis Minnie was born Lizzie Douglas in Algiers, Louisiana in 1897. She started guitar at age 11, ran away from home at 13, and played street corners under the name Kid Douglas. And by the end of the 1920s, she was calling herself Memphis Minnie. Me and My Chauffeur Blues has been recorded over 30 times by everyone from Big Mama Thornton to Nina Simone to Lucinda Williams and the Jefferson Airplane.
Wants to see my chauffeur, wants to see my chauffeur. I want him to drive me, I want him to drive me downtown. Says he drives so easy.
One of Memphis Minnie's biggest devotees is singer Maria Muldaur. She remembers visiting Minnie's grave in Mississippi.
I just felt this awesome, soulful presence, not just of the spirit of Memphis Minnie, surely, but of all the others and all the other people that were such expressive artists. And they were doing it so on the natch. They weren't thinking, well, I'm going to become a blues star and make $1 million. These are people that were expressing their souls on their back porches and expressing themselves about things that were happening to them very immediately. Her songs are very autobiographical, but at the same time, very universal.
And he won't need no passengers.
Memphis Minnie was one of the meanest guitar players of her day. She'd challenge other players to cutting contests and nearly always won.
The unusual thing about Memphis Minnie was the fact that she stood out as one of the few self-accompanying independent women in the down-home blues business.
Historian and author Peter Guralnick.
As Big Bill Brunsey wrote in his autobiography, Big Bill Blues, and he wrote this with great admiration, Memphis Minnie played the guitar just like a man. And he describes this cutting contest in which Memphis Minnie beats everybody, all the famous blues singers, all the men, because there were no other women involved. Just as in the early days of rock and roll, there weren't a lot of early women rockabillies. And it may have had something to do with the difficulties of travel. It may have been an exclusive organization. But I think more than anything, it was a very hard life and not many women chose it. But Memphis Minnie did, to our great edification.
Between 1929 and 1941, Minnie recorded over 150 songs, many of which have become classics like Me and My Chauffeur, Bumblebee, and When the Levee Breaks. One of the lucky guitarists to record with Memphis Minnie was Jimmy Rogers, who for years famously played with Muddy Waters and Little Walter.
Little Walter and I, we made records with her. I enjoyed the old lady, you know. She would tell you what to do and how to do it, and I'd say, okay, Minnie, all right. I was young, trying to learn. Greatest day of my life, to play the blues with Memphis Minnie. Yeah.
Minnie made records into the 1950s. In 1960, a stroke put her in a wheelchair, but she never stopped playing guitar. Memphis Minnie died in 1973 at the age of 76.
Wanna let my chauffeur, wanna let my chauffeur drive me around the, drive me around the world. That he can be my little boy, yes, I'll be his girl.
Memphis Minnie and Me and My Chauffeur Blues, recorded in 1941 and just this year added to the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. From Memphis, we go back in time to New York City, where the very first blues record was made. It was 1920, and records were becoming big business in the white world, but at that point, no company had ever recorded a blues singer. Crazy Blues was the song, and Mamie Smith was the artist. The song was entered into the National Recording Registry in 1994 as a tribute to its importance to American culture. To tell the story of Crazy Blues, we have an archivist.
My name is Michael Taft. I'm the head of the Archive of Folk Culture at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
An author.
My name is Lawrence Cohn, and I'm quite proud of a book I did in 1996 called Nothing But the Blues, the Music and the Musicians.
And an activist turned educator.
My name is Angela Davis. I am professor of History of Consciousness and Feminist Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I am also the author of Blues Legacies and Black Feminism. Mamie Smith was the first vocalist to record the blues.
Mamie Smith was rather peculiar. It's funny that she was the first to record this kind of blues because she was not primarily a blues singer. At the age of 10, she was on the stage dancing, and she was a dancer and a singer and an actress, and she performed in films in the 30s and 40s. She was an all-around entertainer, but I don't think she herself would have called herself necessarily a blues singer in the way that perhaps Ma Rainey or Bessie Smith were.
These people who recorded in the early 20s were working as vaudevillians in various guises, as dancers, as comedians, as singers.
But no black blues singer had been recorded in 1920. And in a sense, it was happenstance that Mamie Smith acquired the opportunity to record Crazy Blues. Earlier in the year, Sophie Tucker had been scheduled for a recording session, but became ill. And Perry Bradford managed to persuade OK Records to allow Mamie Smith to do the recording session instead.
And Bradford, who I got to know when I was a teenager in the 50s, he wrote these songs and he produced them. And he really is the guy that sold the concept to the record companies that black female vaudevillians could translate to blues and that there was money to be made.
That recording sold really well.
Right out of the box, I think they sold something like 10,000 recordings the first week.
Within a month, it had sold over 75,000 copies.
There was a market there that had not been served. And Mamie Smith and her recording was, if you like, the opening shot. I think the black public was ready to start buying records. There was enough of a working class with money that were ready, willing, and able to buy recordings that were coming out of their own culture.
The recording of Crazy Blues led the way for the professionalization of black music, for the black entertainment industry, and indeed for the immense popularity of black music today. So there was a time in the history of this country when white people were able to live and experience what they thought of as American culture without having the slightest idea about the creativity of black people. And now, of course, black music stands in for American musical culture, not only within the country, but all over the world.
Mamie Smith and Crazy Blues recorded in New York in 1920. It was the very first recording of a blues musician. The song was entered into the National Recording Registry and will be preserved for all time. We're listening to the Sounds of America, recordings selected for the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. Our salute takes us to Detroit and Chicago when Red, White, and the Blues continues in a moment. I'm Celeste Headlee, and you're listening to 1A, from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and we're celebrating the 4th of July by focusing on an original African-American art form, the blues. We're calling this hour Red, White, and the Blues, and playing songs from the National Recording Registry. Our next musical offering takes us to the epicenter of electrified blues music, Chicago, in the 1950s and 60s. On the heels of the Depression and World War II, there was a mass exodus of African Americans from the South, heading north, looking for better working and living conditions. They brought their music, but traditional acoustic music just wasn't loud enough for the big city, and electrified blues was born. An icon of this new music was Chester Burnett, better known as Howlin' Wolf, and his seminal recording of Smokestack Lightning was chosen for the registry in 2009. To tell us about the song, we'll hear from three people who were important to Howlin' Wolf.
My name is Hubert Sumlin.
I'm a guitar player.
My name is Betty Kelly. I'm Howlin' Wolf's oldest daughter.
I'm Dick Sherman, and I am a producer, journalist, historian.
Oh, Smokestack Lightning, shining just like gold, but don't you hear me cry?
Smokestack Lightning is indeed a monument of the blues. It shows historical continuity. It shows the power of Howlin' Wolf as an individual. It captures a feeling that summarizes the blues pretty much as well as any recording ever has.
Well, tell me, baby, what's don't matter, yeah, but don't you hear me cry?
Woo. Smokestack Lightning was a number they recorded for Sun Labor, Edward Presley's people. He had his old band, Willie Johnson, and all them old guys back there at that time.
Oh, Smokestack Lightning, shining just like gold.
Wolf was Sam Phillips' favorite recording artist of all time, and considering that Sam was the discoverer of Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, a lot of other great blues artists, that's certainly high praise. He is widely quoted as saying about Wolf that the first time he heard him, he said, he thought to himself, this is where the soul of man never dies.
He loved his harmonica. I think that harmonica was his outlet. there are moments when I can get a book maybe and quiet and curl up and just read it a little bit, feel better when I come out. I think that harmonica did that for him.
I done started to make records on the plantation. Man come through there picking a guitar called Charlie Patton. And I liked his sound. So I always did want to play a guitar. So I got him to show me a few chords, you know. Every night that I'd get off of work, I'd go over to his house and he'd learn me how to pick the guitar.
Howlin' Wolf not only was inspired by the music of Charlie Patton, but directly took lessons from him when they were on the same plantation. And Smokestack Lightning, for which Wolf will probably always be known, is a descendant of a song by Patton called Moon Going Down.
And what happened, Wolf was sold to Chess Records by Sun Lever. And so when he got to Chess Records, we recorded Smokestack Lightning over again. My original sound of Smokestack Lightning was the sound that I wanted him to have.
Smokestack Lightning is about a lot of things, particularly if you listen to the lyrics. First of all, part of it does seem to be about the poetic image of the sparks from the cinders coming out of the smokestack of a locomotive at night, which is a pretty powerful image. But then there's also a verse about, you know, tell me where you stayed last night. So I think it's also about lonesomeness and anxiety and a whole lot of mysticism woven in there.
I think Smokestack Lightning is about a disappointment in a love relationship that he was having at the time. And he was trying to get her to understand that they could work it out and they could stay with it. But I think she had been attracted to someone else and it was hurting him.
I had a woman once, she was kind of nice to me, and she pulled off and left me. And that gave me the blues, sure enough. I went to howling like a dog then, you know what I mean?
You better believe every song that this guy made, it's a little bit of where he lived, the way he lived too, and what he went through. This is what it's all about, man. And that guy he did not lie. I ain't never knowed him to tell a lie, man, about anything that I knows anything.
This is 1A with Red, White, and the Blues, profiles of music chosen for the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. We just heard from Howlin' Wolf and Smokestack Lightning, with commentary from historian Dick Sherman, Wolf's daughter, Betty Kelly, Wolf's guitarist, Hubert Sumlin, and the Howlin' Wolf himself. From Chicago, our musical journey takes us to Detroit. Perhaps best known for Motown soul and R&B, the Motor City has a rich blues tradition, personified by John Lee Hooker. His song, Boogie Chillin', went to number one on the R&B charts in 1949 and pretty much shaped all the blues and rock music that followed. To tell us the story of Boogie Chillin', we have a veteran author.
I'm Peter Guralnick. I'm a writer. I've written a number of books, but the thing that really got me started is the blues, and it's something that I discovered when I was 15, and it has never left me.
And a veteran blues musician.
My name is Charlie Musselwhite, and I first met John Lee Hooker in Chicago, probably about 63, I believe. First time I heard Boogie Chillin' that I remember was, there was two radio stations I used to listen to in Memphis, but they came from other places, WLAC out of Nashville, and XCRF from Ciudad Acuña, Coahuila, Mexico. and they would play blues and R&B late at night, and I could get them on my little radio at home in Memphis. I remember hearing John Lee late at night coming through the little speaker of my radio. It was just had kind of almost a sinister sound to it. It was so so powerful.
John Lee Hooker is one of the giants of contemporary blues. He's one of the giants of the down-home blues that took over after the Second World War and really revolutionized, electrified blues music.
Well, my mother allowed me just to stay out all night long. Oh, Lord. When I was waking the town, people, I was walking down Hazen Street.
When I first met him in Chicago, he was still living in Detroit. He hadn't moved out to California yet. Some of the places he mentioned, like the Henry Swing Club and the areas he talked about, were being torn down, and that whole scene in Detroit was disappearing at that time.
John Lee Hooker's roots are definitely in the Delta. It has elements of that kind of modal style, where essentially he just stays on the same chord, and it's rhythmic to a degree that so much of Mississippi blues is.
Boogie Chillin'.
In the song Boogie Chillin', you've got a song that is basically, it's about life itself. It's a celebration of all things. It's, as Howlin' Wolf once sang, it's nature. I mean, it's human nature. The point is, you can deny all you want, all your illicit desires and all the things, you know, that you may feel in the dark of night. But man, if it's in you, it's gonna come out. You can't hide.
One night I was laying down. I heard Mama and Papa talking. I heard Papa tell Mama, let that boy boogie woogie. It's in him, and it got to come out.
You know, he was singing from the point of view of a young man, you know, when he recorded and when he wrote and recorded that tune.
Went on boogie just the same.
He wanted to boogie, and he had to, and he was feeling his oats, and that's what being a young man is all about, you know.
We heard about John Lee Hooker's Boogie Chillin' from Peter Guralnick and Charlie Musselwhite. That song is immortalized in the National Recording Registry, which preserves audio echoes from the past. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and our Red, White, and the Blues salute to African American music continues with a stop in Los Angeles by way of Texas. Aaron T-Bone Walker was born in Linden, Texas in 1910. T-Bone Walker's technique is considered the gold standard for electric guitarists, and his song, Call It Stormy Monday, has become a classic. To tell the story of Stormy Monday, we have a blues guitarist.
My name is Duke Robillard, and I'm a guitar player, singer, songwriter, and producer.
The king of the blues?
I'm B.B. King. I play the guitar, and I call it Lucille. I'm a blues singer, blues musician.
And T-Bone's offspring.
My name is Bernita Ruth Walker. I am the daughter of Aaron T-Bone Walker, Sr. I was born in 1946, the year that he actually wrote They Call It Stormy Monday.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad.
What makes Stormy Monday vital today is it's so befitting for many of our lives that we go through. You know, Monday morning, most people don't want to get up to go to work because they've had a great time over the weekend and now they've got to hit that 9 to 5. And as it progressed, you know, Tuesday is just as bad. Wednesday's worse because that's the hump day. And Thursday is also
sad. The eagle flies on Friday. The eagle flies on Friday means that he gets paid.
Yeah! Flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out to play.
Meaning, I go out and party on Saturday, you know, which is still a common practice.
Eagle flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out to play. Sunday I go to church. Then I kneel down and pray.
T-Bone Walker single-handedly developed the style and way to play blues on electric guitar that was totally different than anything that had done before. He used a lot of double timing in his soloing, which at that time was something that only horn players did. You never heard a guitar player do it. Very unusual and very innovative. Be playing actually twice as many notes per beat. He really completely set the foundation for how blues guitar was to be played. If you talk to B.B. King, he'll, I'm sure, say something very similar to that.
I'd never heard anyone play like him or like that before. What makes T-Bone Walker so special? He played his guitar different from anyone else. He didn't play the guitar with the body of the guitar laying against him. He played the guitar with it turned horizontal. He would play it like that, and it looks so today, then, if that's a good word. He was a very handsome-looking guy. He looked like an entertainer. He had that stage presence.
And he would do the splits in time with the music that he was playing. And the women would scream and holler, and even the men were clapping like, "Go Bone, go Bone." And I would just sit there smiling because that was my dad that was doing those great performances.
And some of the ideas that he had developed into ideas that were important in the beginning of rock and roll guitar. Chuck Berry just took T-Bone style and put it to a different beat. So, in essence, T-Bone was not only the first electric blues guitar player, but he was the first electric rock and roll guitar player, really. If a young guitar player comes up and he starts learning guitar off a Stevie Vaughan record or just any contemporary guitar player, he is still playing a lot of the technique that was invented by T-Bone Walker.
He had a way of bending the notes on his guitar that made it stand out from anybody else I ever heard.
They call it Stormy Monday is one of those blues standards. At home, I have approximately 9 CDs that have maybe 15 versions on each CD by different artists of that song. So it was just something that grabbed them about that song.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad.
Doing that blues thing, we're going to play this old Bobby Bland song for you. Actually, it's a T-Bone Walker song.
The guitar chord line, there's a little guitar ninth chord figure. Dun, da, do, dun, do, da, do, 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 which is, that was like a unique thing, and it became T-Bone's signature, is that little, that type of line. And that chord line, I don't know, it seems to have grabbed everybody because everybody plays it with that line in it. And it's almost like a law that you have to when you play Stormy Monday.
Crazy about my baby. Yeah, send her back to me.
Call It Stormy Monday from Aaron T-Bone Walker. And we heard the voices of Bernita Walker, Duke Robillard, and B.B. King. It's our 4th of July salute to the sounds of America with music from the National Recording Registry. We call it Red, White, and the Blues. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll add some rhythm to the blues. That's next on 1A. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. We call this hour Red, White, and the Blues, a celebration of an original African-American art form. As the blues migrated from the fields of the South to the cities of the North, the music evolved, morphed, and reinvented itself. When blues mated with country music, it became rock and roll. When blues and gospel music combined, we got rhythm and blues, R&B. An epicenter of R&B or soul music was the Stax Record Studio in Memphis, and one of the biggest hits to come out of Stax was Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour. This 1965 classic was entered into the registry 3 years ago. To start us on the tale of In the Midnight Hour, we have a card-carrying blues brother.
Dan Aykroyd. I'm an artist, writer, actor, I guess you could say. You know, Wilson Pickett was just briefly in the Blues Brothers 2000. I was Elwood, and he was Wilson Pickett. And he was great to work with, and he was appreciative of the focus, you know. But what you got with the Wicked Pickett was an edge in music that many of the other artists of the time did not have. Kind of a dangerous edge, unpredictable, and occasionally bearing weapons.
Wilson was what I would call a natural shouter. He had that foot-stomping Baptist church shouting voice that, in his case, he could shout and scream in tune.
Oh, 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 I need your good loving, baby.
I'm Tony Fletcher. I'm an author, and I wrote the biography In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett. He had signed to Atlantic Records, who had really kind of misjudged where he sat in the market. They were not the right people to be writing for Wilson Pickett. He really needed to be in with really R&B musicians, and he probably needed to be back down south. I think both Wilson and Jerry Wexler, who was his point person at Atlantic, both were of the same mind for different reasons, that what would make sense for Wilson Pickett would be to see if they could get him in at the Stax Studios down in Memphis.
Hi there, this is Steve Cropper.
Steve Cropper was the sort of de facto producer for all the sessions at Stax, but he was also a part of the backing band in the studio that backed Otis Redding, that backed Sam and Dave, that backed Eddie Floyd, Wilson Pickett, Carla Thomas, all the way through.
Jerry Wexler had called Jim Stewart, who was the president of Stax, and told Jim, we've got this artist we want to bring down and have you record. I didn't know Wilson Pickett at the time. But I worked in a record shop, so we started looking for things that he might have sung on, and somewhere somebody came up with a gospel record. I remember playing the fade out over and over because he'd go into this chant about, I'm going to wait till the midnight hour, I'm going to see my Jesus in the midnight hour, whoa, in the midnight hour.
Wilson didn't just come up with the idea of singing about in the midnight hour. The phrase the midnight hour had been around in gospel music. It was a very, very common phrase.
Jim and I pick up Jerry and Wilson at the airport in Memphis. Go to the hotel, which was that time a Holiday Inn, it's not there anymore, at the corner of Poplar Avenue and Crosstown. And Jerry said, Jim and I are going to go eat something and have a meeting. You guys go ahead and get started writing.
When I went down to Memphis, I took four or five hit songs down there that I had written. Steve Cropper was a very together guy. Like he would pitch in, he would jump in there. If something needed changing or something needed doing this way or that way, then he was good at doing that. So he'd come to my hotel, we put everything there together, make it right.
And about, I don't know, about 2 hours later or so, knock on the door, opened it, and Jerry says, how's it going? So we played him two songs. And he said, man, I'm getting out of here. You guys are doing well. He said, just keep writing.
They went in the next day and recorded these four songs, and one of them, of course, was In the Midnight Hour.
The midnight hour, I guess, is when a man and a woman are in a room together and it's time to decide whether there's going to be some kind of a consensual interaction.
To me, essentially, it's a moment of loving. I mean, it's really like that dark hour of the night.
Wilson, actually, what happens at the midnight hour? What actually goes on once the clock strikes 12?
All sorts of things. You had to get up and take the dog out. I mean, anything could happen.
You hear Donald Duck Dunn with the most obvious of bass lines. It's really just an arpeggio on the two chords that run through the verse. Yet something in the way that he plays it has made it one of the most idealized bass lines that you would ever come across. Over the top of Donald Duck Dunn's wonderful arpeggio and with the brass dancing all around it is Al Jackson on drums and Steve Cropper really coming down together on that 2 and 4.
Jerry Wexler was the acting producer because he had brought Wilson down. And he didn't like what I was playing, and he said, Steve, can you just play straight backbeats?
Steve would have had every right to say, Mr. Wexler, you know, we're the guys making hits here. You haven't delivered a hit for Wilson Pickett. We know what we're doing. Could you kindly leave us alone and we'll get on with what we're doing? But Steve did not say that. He listened to Jerry.
Some people out there might not know what a backbeat is, and that's usually what the drummer plays, and he usually puts it in R&B on 2 and 4. 1, 2, accent, 3, then 4. Very heavy. The accent on 2 and 4 keeps everybody's little booty moving, and that's what we always did.
Which apparently was influenced by a big dance at the time and a number one hit called The Jerk.
The Jerk, you have seen it performed right here on Hollywood A Go-Go. Let me give you a few simple basic facts. All you have to do is take the bump, bump, bump beat.
It was like a pull down, put your hands or fists up in the air and kind of pull down towards your belt line. And if you do that on 2 and 4, then that's called a jerk.
To emphasize the point, apparently, Jerry came out of the control room. This is a guy who was already well into middle age. And so it's like their dad coming out of the control room and he starts demonstrating the jerk in the studio, looking a little bit like a sort of out of shape middle-aged boxer in the process.
In a big studio, very big studio, and we didn't do anything in those days with headphones. They might have been invented, but we didn't use them. I learned to stay right with the drummer by watching his left hand.
Back in those days, this was being recorded all in one go, all in one take, live to tape. The brass section did not come in afterwards. You know, there's no overdubs to this. This is the recording, the one take recording. And so you've got to imagine 8 musicians plus Wilson Pickett in a room with a sloping studio, recording live to 2-track.
The horns are vital to these tracks. They produce this fullness and this breadth and width in the music that was kind of missing in rock and roll.
They play in a way that manages to sound at once both sort of laid back and incredibly urgent at the same time. The brass comes in as if it's almost an afterthought, and yet the more that you listen to that brass, the more you realize it suits the song. And obviously, Wilson Pickett's performance is absolutely stellar.
Struck me about seeing him and hearing him was just the full-on commitment, the vibrancy and the edge and the danger in his performance, you know, and that wonderful voice he had, just at the top of his capabilities, and he always pushed it and never held back at all.
Wilson Pickett and In the Midnight Hour, one of the songs being preserved in the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. We also heard from Dan Aykroyd, Steve Cropper, Tony Fletcher, and the wicked Wilson Pickett himself. It's 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this July 4th holiday, we're presenting some of the blues-based music featured in the registry. a salute to Red, White, and the Blues. Our final musical offering is another example of how the blues can distort into a completely new form of expression. Are You Experienced, the debut album from Jimi Hendrix, took the blues to new heights and knocked the rock world on its ear. The album was inducted into the registry in 2005. To learn more about Are You Experienced, we talked to a musician.
This is Vernon Reed, and I'm a guitarist, songwriter, composer, and music producer. And I've been involved with a wide range of musics, from world music to funk to harmonic free jazz to metal. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Jimi Hendrix.
A recording engineer.
My name is Eddie Kramer. I was involved in the Are You Experienced album as engineer.
And an archivist.
I'm Reuben Jackson, and I'm an archivist at the National Museum of American History, Smithsonian Institution. It's still a landmark recording because it is of the tradition, you know, the rock, R&B, blues, what have you, musical tradition. But I think it altered the syntax of the music, if you will, in a way I compare to, say, like James Joyce's Ulysses. You read this, you read, you know, a page or two of Ulysses, and maybe you listen to just Purple Haze, and you think, my goodness, what is this?
We were experimenting. That was the exciting part, was that whatever he did in the studio, we had to just keep up and try to figure out how to record it in a halfway decent fashion. Excuse me while
I kiss the sky. I think Jimmy's singing, and I think his lyrics have often been given short shrift in consideration of his guitar playing, because his guitar playing was so overwhelmingly powerful. See, there was no dividing line in Hendrix between the song, the improvisation, the singing. It was all one thing. If you can just get your
mind together, then come on across to me. I mentioned his interest in science fiction, and this guy wrote a lot of poetry and was very influenced by Bob Dylan. I've often wondered to what extent Dylan's influence on a piece like Are You Experienced? But first, are you experienced? Experienced, you know, is he talking about drugs? Is he talking about sex? Is he talking about all the above? And you never know, it's kind of inferred, but then you've got those kind of backward swirling guitars contributing to this lyrical foundation.
Jimmy's backwards guitar was an effect that he rehearsed. Contrary to popular belief, I would say Jimi Hendrix was extremely well prepared. He had a very clear concept of what it would take to come up with the goods. So, are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Let me prove it to you. I would give him rough mixes of songs that we'd been working on, and he would take them home and experiment on his own tape machine. He would take the tape, put it in his machine, and play it backwards and rehearse to it, so that by the time he came back to the studio the following day, he would have planned out precisely what he was going to play for a solo. And we would turn the tape upside down, and he would know precisely where he was by the sound of the tape, so okay, would stop there, play it from there, and record from there to there. And he would say exactly where he wanted to go. And he would play the solo, and then we'd flip the tape back on the forward direction, and out would come this incredibly beautiful melodic solo that was perfectly structured from the beginning to the end. Are You Experienced, I think, is the groundbreaking album that everybody should listen to first before you get onto the rest of the music that he wrote. Here's a man who is completely at ease and completely at one with his guitar. This is a milestone, much in the same way that any of the great jazz musicians had made classic albums, I think Jimmy had made his first statement.
After all the jets are in the boxes and the clowns have all gone to bed.
I was at a school recently doing some poetry with some fifth graders, and a young lady had a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt on, and I, of course, I had to ask her about this. And she said, oh, I just love that music. It just makes me want to go in my room and paint and write things. And, you know, he was someone who painted and wrote. So it's not just, you know, old school guys. You know, if a fifth grader can just get kind of wide-eyed and excited as this young lady did, I thought, boy, you know, this guy really had something. And still does.
The story of Are You Experienced from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, an album being preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. And telling us about the album, we had Vernon Reed, Eddie Kramer, and Reuben Jackson. If you know of an audio recording, and it doesn't have to be music, that you think is important to preserve for generations to come, you can submit it to the Recording Registry. Email recregistry@loc.gov. That's recregistry@loc.gov. Today's producers were Ben Manila and Jenny Cataldo of BMP Audio. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Thank you so much for listening. Happy birthday, America. This is 1A.